Tonight's guest is Big Earn, or as you know him by his real name, Karsten. He just got back from some travels, and so we were super excited to catch up with him on how his travels have been going and how it feels to leave work and be early retired.
We go real deep on a few topics with him. The first is on his safe withdrawal rate study. So he has a 28 series, I mean, entire, like, this is exactly how you do it. Here's a free Google Drive spreadsheet that practically has like 25 pivot tables. If you are a spreadsheet nerd, you're going to go to his site right now and download that, earlyretirementnow.com. And we also talk about being an accredited investor, which is something that I don't think a lot of us know about. There's an income limit to that, but once you are one, it opens tons of doors and you can invest in real estate or startups. We talk particularly about the real estate scenario. These are real estate deals that you cannot find online. You can't invest in these. Like, it's kind of who you know, and you need to be an accredited investor to do that. So it's a really deep, interesting conversation. We're all going to nerd out together here, and we hope you enjoy it.
Let's nerd out.
Welcome to Fire Drill Podcast, where side hustles, savings, and creativity lead to financial independence. With your hosts, Gwen from Fiery Millennials and Jay from Millennial Boss.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Fire Drill. We are so excited to have Karsten, aka Big Earn, on the podcast. Welcome.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
And Gwen is here too.
I would say it's our pleasure to have you on our podcast.
As opposed to other people's podcasts.
Sorry. As I feel the other podcasts.
Many. I'm sorry.
I haven't done very many. So.
It was a weird way to phrase that.
Yeah.
So let's have you start out by telling everyone a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I'm Karsten. I'm 44 years old, and I retired a few months ago in June this year. And my wife is also retired. In fact, she retired even a few months before me. And I'm from Germany originally, but I moved to the U.S. over 23 years ago for grad school. And I did my master's and PhD in economics at, guess where? University of Minnesota. And then, until retirement, I worked in finance. So first at the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, I was an economist there. Also did some teaching gigs on the side as a visiting professor at Emory University. That's also in Atlanta. And then the last 10 years before retirement, so 2008 till 18, I worked for a large asset manager in San Francisco. And then after retirement, we've been traveling. So June 1st was my last day at the office. And June 5th, we started our big trip. And so we're currently homeless. So we sold our condo in January, then rented for a while till we left San Francisco. And then we won't be back until December. So it's just under 7 months of traveling. And then probably it'll settle down again.
That sounds epic.
Epic. So one, it's really nice to have another voice who has actually pulled the trigger and early retired. So that's really cool. And we can't wait to talk to you about that. And two, it sounds like you're doing this amazing travel. And last week, were you on like a cruise or something? What were you doing last week?
Yeah, so we spent a little over 2 months in Europe, so on Europe mainland. And then on September 1st, we took a cruise ship back from Amsterdam to the US. It's not direct. You do a few stops here and there. So we did 4 stops in Ireland, so 3 in Ireland proper and 1 in Northern Ireland, which obviously belongs to UK. So it was Waterford, Dublin, and Cork in Ireland, and Belfast in Northern Ireland. And then another stop was in the Azores. That's a group of islands that belongs to Portugal, but it's about 1,000 miles west from Portugal. So it's the middle of nowhere in the Atlantic.
I've heard they're beautiful.
It's absolutely beautiful. So it's basically, think of Hawaii meets Southern European culture. So the landscape reminds you very much of Hawaii. So these lush green hillsides. Then in the villages and towns, you have this Portuguese and Spanish influence. It's very pretty. And then from September 9th until September 17th, so it's one long stretch, no stops. The cruise ship went straight west. And so then we landed in Tampa. That was on the 17th. So now we're in Florida, right in time for FinCon. So looking forward to that.
See you there.
Yeah. Yeah,
we're very excited to go.
It's a big reunion. Yeah.
For sure.
Literally the highlight of my year. I don't know how sad that is that a financial blogging conference is the highlight of my year.
Yeah, that's a little bit interesting. But I know what you mean. We always have a great time there.
Yeah, and it's my first time at FinCon. I was thinking about going last year, and I thought, well, you know, I'm still not out in the open. So I had that hesitation. I don't want to go there and people recognize me afterwards on the pictures. So this year I can go worry-free because I'm out in the open.
I can definitely relate to that.
Yes.
Yeah. So what has life been like? I know this is a very open-ended question, but how does it actually feel to walk away from your job? Like, I can imagine when you're traveling, are you, you know, nervous about like pulling out your credit card when you want to buy something? Whereas when you're working, you're like, oh, whatever, I'll just, you know, pay it off later.
Yeah, exactly. So it's this transition from making so much money that you have money left over to save something like 50% of your income every, not every month, but let's say the annual average. And now you go and you have to live off your money. So it's a little bit scary, that's for sure. Of course, the way I structured that transition is that, well, we have a little bit of money set aside that's basically just sitting there as cash and bonds. So we can live off of that for a while before we dig into, it's a little bit irrational thinking, right? Because this kind of money is fungible, right? Whether you take it out of stocks or out of that pot or out of that pot, it's all the same. But I think just for calming down your mind, I think it's useful to have a little bit of that pile of cash sitting on the side. And then I also still receive a little bit of deferred compensation that's stretched out over another 3 years. So it's probably not enough to cover all of our expenses, but part of the expenses. It's not a cold turkey. You go from having an income to starting to live off your portfolio, whereas you go from having an income to having to cover half of your expenses out of your portfolio over 3 years. And then after that, you have to cover all of your expenses out of your portfolio. So it's a little bit more of a gradual transition to that full early retirement where your portfolio is all you have.
Well, and that helps with the sequence of returns, right?
So right,
if exactly. Something happens in the first 3 years, you don't have to take the money out of your portfolio or as much, I guess.
Right, right. And that's always what I say. I want to have multiple levers that I can pull when there's the next bear market coming, right? It's not if, it's about when. So one lever is to have a little bit of cash sitting on the side. Another one is, well, to just be flexible with your spending and basically have the opportunity to cut your spending by a certain percentage without feeling too bad about it. So, I'm no big fan of the 4% rule, as people might have heard about. We have a little bit of a lower withdrawal rate than 4%. So there's a little bit more wiggle room for us. But even then, it feels a little bit weird from going to have a salary to living off your money, basically going from June 1st to June 2nd. I definitely admit that.
So I'm looking now at your early retirement now withdrawal toolbox version 2.0, yeah. Google Sheet, DIY. Like, I don't even know how to describe this thing, but it's very intricate. So we're going to link to this in the show notes for anyone who wants to see a really in-depth withdrawal strategy worksheet.
Right.
But tell us a little bit about what you're thinking when you made this.
Well, I mean, this has obviously grown after, I think this is now a 28-part series on safe withdrawal rates. And so my thinking is that we can never have one single percentage rate that should apply to everybody, right? It depends on at what age do you retire? Are you a really early retiree? You retire in your 20s? Or are you a little bit older? You're in your 40s. You're closer to Social Security. You might have some corporate pension, or some people have a government pension. So we can't all have the same withdrawal rate. So it's almost as ludicrous as saying we should all wear the same shoe size, right? So people say, well, 4% is a good starting point. This is like saying you go shoe shopping and you say, well, size 10 is a good starting point for everybody. So I think that this whole withdrawal strategy should be something that is just as customized as picking your shoe size, or should be just as customized as having a custom suit made for you or any other custom garment for you.
I love that analogy. Seriously, that's genius. The 4% rule doesn't work for everybody. Just like not everybody should be wearing a size 10 shoe. That's brilliant.
And then, of course, I don't want to make the mistake and now say, well, instead of size 10, we should all wear size 9 shoe. In fact, in the beginning, maybe I started a little bit going down that rabbit hole. But that's obviously just as wrong as the 4% rule. If I say, well, we should now say make it a 3.5% rule. because I've also done some case studies for volunteers. And well, I actually figured out, well, they can get away with even more than 4% because they were older. They had relatively generous pensions that are going to kick in soon. So it should be more or less a more customized exercise. Well, and how do you do this customized exercise? You should have a way of inputting all of your future cash flows that you expect. So this could be positive cash flows, or this could be pensions. And then you should have a distinction between, well, is this an inflation-adjusted pension, like many public pensions are? Or is this a nominal pension? You get a certain dollar amount, and then this is going to basically get deflated away by the CPI inflation rate. So we should have a way where people can quickly and easily enter some of that information and then check in the past with historical returns, how would my portfolio have performed? Would I have run out of money over, say, a 50-year or 55-year or even 60-year retirement horizon? And again, I mean, this doesn't mean that this is going to be applicable in the future, but you could make the case that, you know, future bear markets are going to look probably like past bear markets. It could be a big demand shock recession, like in the Great Depression or in the 2000s, or it could be a very inflationary recession, like in the 1970s, where both stocks and bonds get hammered. So it is definitely something we can learn from the past. So because this is something that people have to do and custom fit to their own needs, I thought it would be good if I could make this Google sheet that I use for my own purposes, so people can also set up their own calculations and see what are different fail-safe withdrawal rates. Is it the fail-safes below 4% or above 4%? And then they can calculate different failure rates over the historical simulations. And this has grown over more than a year, and I've gotten a lot of feedback. Hey, can you add this feature, that feature? It's a pretty neat little tool.
I wouldn't call it a neat little tool. It's an epic. It is awesome. So thank you for putting that together for everyone. That's so helpful.
Yeah.
And I swear it's not as complicated as he's making it sound. Like, he has like the 28 different series steps, and there's a lot of different like interesting discussion happening in the comments. It's really cool. So if anyone is into like spreadsheeting and modeling, you're going to love this. And it's free, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's 100% totally free.
Yeah, 100% free. Yeah.
That's the FIRE community's favorite price, free 99.
Free 99. So true. Karsten, you are someone who, you're post-retirement and you're in your 40s. So you were very patient for a very long time. Sometimes it feels like a lot of us, particularly the millennial group, we get very impatient and we want to, once we hear about early retirement, it's like, wait, is it tomorrow? Is it tomorrow? And then it's like, no, like it's literally 15 years from now. Like, calm down. How do you deal with that long slog of time?
Yeah, in that sense, I mean, I'm fortunate that I didn't know about early retirement until, I guess, 2 years ago. I should say that I was always planning to retire earlier, certainly earlier than 65 or 67. I mean, it took me until 2016 to actually find out about Mr. Money Mustache and then some of the other successful early retirees. It's much easier, you know, ignorance is bliss in some way, right? You don't even know that that existed. And well, to basically diligently save over a time span of. So in my case, I finished grad school at age 26. That's when I started having a real income. And then I worked for 8 years at the Federal Reserve. Yeah, I had a pretty decent savings rate, maybe 25% or so. I wouldn't really qualify as striving for FIRE, but I got really serious about saving when I started working in finance, because it's such a volatile work environment. You see firms fail, you see people getting laid off everywhere. So I had an incentive to save 50% of my salary. And I did that for 10 years and then boom, then you're there. And I totally agree. It's hard to see so many other people retire and you realize, yeah, I mean, I would get there too, but it's going to take me 6 more years and people get impatient and it's like watching paint dry, right? For a whole decade. Yeah, I could see that some people want to pull the plug earlier. But again, I was never in that situation of feeling that urge. I kind of stumbled into early retirement at some point. Again, I always wanted to retire a little bit earlier. And then I realized, hey, I'm in the early 40s, I'm almost there. And even the last 2 years, again, so the last 2 years after you know that everybody else is doing it. And I'm still not quite there. And do it another year and another year. It was a little bit hard to do that and to keep the discipline. And then also, obviously, keep the motivation at the workplace, right? So you go to the office every day. Nobody knows what you're planning. And to keep going for 2 years, and that was hard. So I can see that some millennials get impatient.
So impatient. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I couldn't even wait 5 years. I was like, all right, done.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, I had a really good reason to quit my job and move, but making it on my own instead of, you know, just patiently waiting out the 5 years, couldn't do it. You get mad props from me.
I guess it depends on whether you find your current job fulfilling, I think.
Yeah. And I did. So I think I had a very good gig at my firm. So I was senior enough that, you know, I was making good salary. I had nice window office and people wouldn't bother me too much because there were not that many people in the firm that would have the status to mess with me. And the ones that could, they actually liked me very much. So I was quite senior, but not that senior that I would have to deal with a lot of the corporate BS and the politics. So it was a good gig and it was hard to give that up. Yeah. And then on top of that, right, I worked in finance. So I can't hate finance because I'm doing personal finance and there's obviously some overlap there. So I'm very interested in finance in general. So in that sense, there was something that kept me going to work every day and have fun at work in that sense.
So one question that I have about early retirement, and this may seem like a very naive question, and I'm not intending this to be a what is the purpose of life question, but what do you feel like the purpose of your life is now? Like, I don't mean that in like a intense way, but what does it feel like? At least when I have my job every day, I get up and I kind of like have something to do and I know what I'm doing. Now it seems like you're traveling, but have you pondered that at all? Like any of those existential questions?
Right. Yeah. I mean, right now, I mean, traveling can almost be a job, right? Because you see a lot of places. And then what we used to do when we were in Europe, we would usually rent an Airbnb for a week. Say we did 1 week in Prague, 1 week in Salzburg, 5 days in Vienna. So then do sightseeing, this museum, that palace. It almost felt so much like a job that after you do this for 4 or 5 days, you almost need a weekend. Settle down every once in a while and say, well, today we just do nothing. We just go to a park or just sit in a cafe and do some people watching. So definitely when you travel, you can fill out time pretty well. So once we are done traveling, obviously the question becomes, how do I fill out my life, right? And I mean, obviously I want to spend more time with my family. We have a 4-year-old daughter. And that was the big opportunity cost, obviously, that I didn't see my wife and I didn't see my daughter for something like 10 to 12 hours every day while I was working. And so obviously we want to spend more time together. At some point, my daughter will go to school. I'll probably volunteer at school, I'll be the chaperone on field trips, things like that. So it's definitely easy to fill out your time when you're early retired, have some ideas about the block, what to do with the block in the future. So definitely I'll fill out the time and I'll have a purpose even in early retirement.
Yeah, I found having a purpose is really huge because otherwise you can just sit at home all day and not do anything. And that is a fast ticket to doing nothing with your life. And I don't want to work hard and stockpile all this up at the beginning just to turn it into nothing. Like, I want to leave an impact on the world.
Yeah. And by the way, I mean, I know some bloggers, they admit very openly and they're almost proud of it. They say, you know what? I like playing video games. I'm not even so much into that. But I think if you do that for a while, but you still do a productive life apart from that, if you want to play some video games for 3-4 hours a day, but then you do other things, you do other fun things when your kids are at home with your family that you weren't able to do before. I mean, then go for it. Just buy an Xbox and go at it. I'm pretty open and I'll see where this all leads us starting in January 2019.
I have a confession to make. Lately, I've been very interested in the startup life and I'm wondering if I was meant to do that.
Like working for a startup or starting a startup?
No, having my own.
Ooh.
Wow.
Because I'm thinking I like working. I am someone that actually really enjoys it. I like working on things that I like to work on, but I don't really see myself not working. And I was very intrigued. I was listening to the founder of Brit & Co. Brit Marin. I don't know if anyone's familiar with her. She was interviewed on Poppy Harlow's podcast. I'll link to it. And she was talking about starting her own company. And her company, it's kind of like a media company that helps women learn how to be creative and like learn how to make things. It kind of reminds me of you, Gwen, actually. Like people who like to make like stained glass or make art or use laser printers or whatever. And I like that idea because it combines the startup life plus using your hands and like being more active. It made me think a lot about all these different things. And perhaps maybe I'm meant to do that, but who knows? So, Karsten, do you see yourself pursuing any type of traditional employment after early retirement, now that you've officially pulled the trigger?
No, I don't think it is going to be traditional employment, but I can definitely see myself doing some other things. So I can give you one example. For example, my wife is a nurse, so she could still do some hourly work on the side. Again, she doesn't want to work 12-hour shifts, graveyard shifts at the hospital, but there are a lot of great opportunities where you just do some hourly work as a nurse. So, I don't know, give flu shots or something like that, right? And so that you have that option. So in my case, I could, for example, do some adjunct teaching job, right? So you pick up one class at a local university, you do some teaching just to stay sharp, to have a purpose, to use that word again, and to have some additional income, obviously, that helps. But I could see doing that. But again, some kind of a corporate job, 40 hours a week, I don't see doing that ever again.
Yeah, my uncle, when he retired, he started doing tax returns for low-income people as like sort of a charity thing and gets a lot out of it. You know, he goes to work for a couple of months and helps people with their tax returns, and then he just takes the rest of the year off.
Yeah, that's awesome. So yeah, volunteering, I could see that too. That's a purpose too. So yeah, absolutely.
So have there been any big surprises in terms of how you feel or what you are doing or your plans for the future since you finally pulled the trigger?
So what surprised me, or maybe didn't surprise me, is I didn't feel any different. My last day at the office was June 1st. And so on June 2nd, it's not like I was suddenly 100% happy. I wouldn't even know how to measure that, right? So I always said that happiness had been priced in over the last year before retirement, kind of slowly went up. And then when I finally retired, I was actually a pretty happy guy, right? You work the last few months at the office. I had announced my retirement decision in February, but they asked me at the office to stick around a little bit longer. And I stayed until June. So it was kind of one big victory lap at the office because I still had to do some knowledge transfer, do some training of people. So in that sense, I was a very happy person before that, and I was a very happy person still on June 2nd. It's not like you're depressed working and then you suddenly have this great jump in happiness because you retired. It just feels the same. And we're traveling now. It feels like a vacation. So in that sense, it was a surprise, but well, it wasn't really a surprise. I was probably expecting that.
The last thing I want to talk about is your alternative investment strategy. So in the FIRE community, we have heard index funds shouted from the rooftops, I would say, and then shouted some more and then fired at us. What is your opinion on that? And then how do you personally choose to invest your money?
Oh, that's a great question. So I am also very much in favor of doing index funds just because I don't really think that I want to mess with picking stocks personally. So I think doing the index fund investing for the bulk of our investments is just fine. But I do two different alternative strategies. And that's just for diversification and to generate features of investment returns that are just a little bit different from equity returns. So we do some real estate investing, and we do that through not the new crowdfunding, right? There's obviously a lot of these platforms now, but we do this through the original crowdfunding. This has been around for many decades, probably even longer than that. It's through private equity funds, right? A bunch of people get together, they form an LLC, they pool their money, and then they buy large pieces of real estate. So we have invested in several funds, and they specialize in large multifamily developments. And we are just some mom and pop investors, so we're actually glad that they let us in. But there's some big institutional investors too that invest in that. We like the return so far. So they basically pool something like anywhere between $100 and $200 million worth of equity from investors, and then they lever that up with a mortgage, and then they pick probably somewhere between 8 to 12 different properties. And so I like real estate as an asset class because it's inflation protection, it's different from corporate equities, it's different from index funds. It generates pretty good income, reliable income. I mean, some of these multifamily real estate funds, they were around for the big housing crisis. And you wonder, oh man, did these guys go under? Did these guys have big losses? And they said, no. I mean, if you didn't buy real estate at the peak and you were forced to sell it at the bottom, which they weren't, right? So even if they bought it close to the peak and they didn't do the leverage too crazy, they didn't have to sell at the bottom. They just kept the properties. So all of these real estate funds did really well. People who moved out of single family houses had to find apartments. So they moved into big apartment complexes. So these multifamily housing funds, they actually did extremely well, even during the Great Recession. So I definitely like that asset class. And the second alternative investment that I'm doing is I do option trading. So I sell put options, S&P 500 index futures.
Before we get into that, I do want to ask you, for your real estate holdings, what do you have and where are they located?
So these are a bunch of different LLCs, and then each LLC has a bunch of sub-LLCs. So each development is its own LLC. So this is for legal protection, so you don't have any spillover of legal liabilities. So they could be anywhere. So a lot of them are in California, Arizona, Virginia, Texas, Oregon, Washington. So it's basically up to the principals of these funds to identify properties that they want to buy. And then usually what they do is they would buy properties that are a little bit in disrepair. So they fix them up and then they hold these properties for somewhere between 5 and 7 years. And then along the way, you get your rental income. And then at the end, you get hopefully a little bit of appreciation in the property.
Okay, so it sounds like you're all over the map with your property. So you've bought them based on return. Did you use the 1% or 2% rule or anything to pick them?
Oh, so I don't pick the properties. These are big funds. They are managed by companies. These are companies are run by people that have been doing this for many decades. So I don't pick anything. I am basically just a silent investor. I own part of the LLC, but I'm not really a decision maker. So there's not even a vote or anything on what properties to buy. This is just completely passive investment. So think of that as almost like, well, you can never have an index fund of real estate. It's always a lot more concentration as you would have in a stock index fund, but it's as close as you can get to that level of diversification because you have the diversification over something like 8 to 12 properties. And then each property is sometimes 70, 80, sometimes several hundred units. So you have some diversification also over the renters, right, over the tenants.
Is this a REIT?
No, it's not a REIT.
It's not a REIT. How do you even get involved in it, I guess? Like what website would you even go to?
No, there's no website. That is the crazy part. I mean, these private equity funds, they have been around for many decades. This is basically the old-fashioned crowdsourcing. And the sad thing is that you have to be an accredited investor. So, and there's a legal definition of that. The implication of that is that these funds cannot be particularly aggressive in marketing these funds. They can't just put an advertisement on Yahoo Finance or something like that and, hey, come invest with us, because there are some laws that prohibit you from marketing this to non-accredited investors. So an accredited investor is someone who has certain income and net worth minimum requirements. So it is basically this old-fashioned, who do you know? So I happened to, so through my job, I knew people working at these funds and they told me about them. And the sad thing is that this is obviously something that only people that already have a sufficient amount of money would know about this. So it cannot be marketed at a greater audience. That's the big disadvantage of these funds. So you have to know somebody who makes the connection So you have to know somebody to even find out about who the players are, who are good providers, who are the not so good providers.
I love when we make it harder for new people to get, you know, financially savvy. It's great. But like the world is just set against, like, if you don't have connections and you're not wealthy. But anyways, I am glad that you mentioned this because I was wondering this the other day if whether or not I should apply or whatever you have to do, I don't even know, to be an accredited investor. So let me list out the requirements for people. So to be considered an accredited investor, one must have a net worth of at least $1 million, excluding the value of one's primary residence, or have an income of at least $200,000 each year for the last 2 years, or $300,000 combined if married, and the expectation to make the same amount. So it sounds like this is, you know, maybe the bucket list of what do you do before you hit retirement, a few years before you pull the trigger, like you should apply to be part of this because this could be something good for you to be part of. And I guess, do you remember, like, is there a cost to be part of this? Is there a yearly fee?
No, it's kind of silly because it is just like your tax return. It is self-reporting. And if nobody bothers to check your credentials, nobody will find out and nobody will complain. So there is no fee to declare yourself an accredited investor. But then, of course, you could say that if anything goes wrong, so if somebody commits fraud and you file a lawsuit, I'm pretty sure that somebody will ask you, well, are you really an accredited investor? Did you lie on that application? So basically what I did personally, the bulk of my savings and most of the time of my savings was with equities. And then only over the last few years, after I was already essentially financially independent, that's when I started shifting some of our assets into this real estate asset class. And you have to be almost financially independent to even start this. It's not really something that people would do as they start out in search of FI.
But one thing you could do is that if you are someone who wants to invest in startups, you have to be an accredited investor to do that.
Pretty much.
I think Doug Norman does that.
Yeah, he's an angel investor.
Yeah, the Military Guide is his website.
Yeah, I know him. I've never met him personally, but I know
he'll
him
be there
really
at FinCon.
All right, yeah, looking forward to meeting him in person. What I like about the real estate route, the angel investing is something like you put some money into some startup and then you do this over a lot of different startups and then you hope and cross your fingers that one of them hits it and you get a lot of money out of that. And then probably 8 out of 10 startups, they will all fail. What I like about the real estate route is that every single investment you do in these real estate private equity funds, there's a regular income, right? So this is not trying to hit it big and trying to win the lottery on one of these funds, because every one of these rental property is a very attractive asset class, right? So even along the way, even before they ever liquidate all of their investments, you already make income along the way. So this is why I like this. And it's a very nice asset class for early retirees. I don't want to sit on a lot of these startup investments as a retiree and nothing is paying off for the first 10 years. So in that sense, the startups is not something that I would necessarily do as a fresh retiree.
That definitely makes sense. Is there anything else that you think someone new to the concept of, by the way, I know that I'm like showing my millennialness here, and I'm sure there's a lot of millennials who are like, we all know about this, like get your act together. But being an accredited investor seems like a, you know, interesting like fire step or thing that should be talked about more. Mm-hmm. You don't have to invest in a REIT. You don't have to actually do real estate yourself. You can invest in these, like, what is it? Is it a trust? Like, what do you even call it? No, it's not a trust.
It's private equities. You're an equity owner in an LLC. And this is the original way these real estate deals have come together historically. I mean, obviously, you have now these crowdfunding platforms that also do real estate related investments. So sometimes it's debt, right? So that you can probably do not being an accredited investor. Usually equity investments where you are an equity holder in the in an LLC, that should normally be something you can only do as an accredited investor. And then there's obviously also different minimums. So some of these private equity deals, they have an investment minimum of $250,000 to $1 million. And I asked them as a small mom and pop investor if they would lower this for me to $100,000. and they allowed that. But I don't think there's a lot of these private equity investments available where they would consider much less than $100,000 minimum investment. So it's obviously the minimum is a lot higher than in some of these crowdfunding platforms.
Got it. Do you write about this on your site?
I have not written about it. I should probably write a blog post about that, about our experience. But we only started with this in 2014. So the funds that we have, they pay their dividends and everything. So it's all good. So it's probably now the time that we should write about this. But again, it's still a bit of a niche investment, right? Not everybody is legally allowed to do this. So why should I write about it? So I already have a niche blog, and then I go even deeper into the niche of accredited investors. I'm debating what's the best way to do that, if anybody would be even interested in that. Because I mentioned the fact that we do these private equity investments here and there in one sentence or another sentence in some blog post. And then people reach out to me and they ask me, hey, can you connect me to the people that you're working with? And I usually do. But it's not like I can recommend certain providers in this space the way other people would be recommending different index funds, right? So some people are Vanguard people, and some people prefer Fidelity, and some prefer Schwab. And it's not like I can do the same thing, because again, I'm almost worried about the legal implications if I recommend any of these on my blog, and then somebody invests in there and then loses money. Would I be on the hook legally if I had recommended that?
I mean, I don't think like a recommendation, I mean, that would be like above and beyond, but many of us don't even know that this exists. And I see your point that it only applies to high income earners or households with high income or high net worth or whatever. But if any community in, at least in the US right now, is going to like fit that mold, pretty sure FIRE community over indexes there, which we like to mock quite a bit on podcasts and blogs, like about the stereotype of a FIRE person, which is not true. It's a diverse community. It's just, you know, there are a lot of repeats of similar stories.
Getting more diverse by the day.
Ooh, very true. Very true. Okay. So I think, Karsten, we're going to wrap it up to our final two, but obviously you are a wealth of knowledge and everyone should go to your blog and connect with you via email, because I think you're like a very needed perspective on early retirement.
There's so much that we could have gotten into and we just couldn't get into because we didn't have the time. So definitely reach out.
Yes. Okay. So the final two. First, if our listeners want to connect with you or learn more about you, how can they do that?
Yeah. So I'm on the internet. It's called earlyretirementnow.com. That's my blog. And that has all the other links. So you can email me through that. I also have my Twitter handle is there on the contact page. And I'm looking forward to getting new readers.
Awesome. Gwen.
Okay, Karsten, the final question. What is your wildest dream?
Oh, I didn't expect that one. Okay. Yeah. So, well, until recently, obviously, the wildest dream was early retirement, right? And that's now a reality. But I always had this dream that was obviously related to early retirement. I always thought that, you know, once we retire, we're going to move somewhere to the mountains and live in the wilderness off the grid. Because you see these TV shows, right? There's people living in Alaska off the grid. So in the back of my mind, I always had that dream. And that's obviously a pretty wild dream. I mean, it's literally a wild dream. But then, of course, reality catches up with you, right? You realize that, you know, I still like my creature comforts. And I like my high-speed internet. And our daughter has to go to school and everything. So we'll probably settle down in the suburb somewhere. But I still wouldn't totally give up on that dream. And so I'll have to check with my wife if she lets me. But I think if the portfolio performs well and everything over the years, and we are over that hurdle and that burden of the sequence of return risk, and we realize that, you know, we're never going to run out of money. We have some money left over. Maybe we'll buy a cabin somewhere in the mountains. So that would be my wild dream, to have a cabin in the mountains where we spend weekends. No, not just weekends, because we're retired. Everything is a weekend now. But have a cabin in the mountains where we can spend quality time and then return to the on-the-grid life every time we need to.
Which mountains do you have your eye on? Just curious.
That's still a secret.
Ah.
You know, So we used to live in San Francisco, California, right? So it's going to be somewhere in the West, obviously. So because we really fell in love with the landscape and nature around here. And it probably won't be in California because taxes are too high and property prices are too high. So we'll find something close, but not in California.
I'm actively mountain hunting for my future dreams too. So
yeah,
I'm interested.
I like mountains. I want to live close enough to a decent ski area that I can go ski, but I don't want to actually like live in the mountains.
Exactly.
I'm sure there's a place that has everything. And if anyone has a place, please share with us. Facebook group, it's where it's at. All right, Karsten, thank you so much for coming on and sharing this knowledge with us. This deep knowledge, we really appreciate it. And we can't wait to meet you next week at FinCon. And I'm sure our listeners will enjoy following up with you on your blog.
Okay, thanks so much. Take care.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Go to our website, firedrillpodcast.com, to continue the discussion and get the link to our private Facebook group.
If you like us, leave us a review on iTunes. If you're like me, you have no idea how to do that. So in the podcast app or in iTunes, search for Fire Drill Podcast, find it, click the reviews tab, and write something to make my mother proud of me. We read every single review and want to say thank you from the bottom of our hearts for making this podcast possible.